So tonight, I'm going to talk about happiness, and in particular, contrast it to some of the things that I think get confused for happiness. First thing I'll say is that it astounds me how much the meaning of this word has changed over the course of a few centuries. I think if you ask many people today, what does happiness mean? It would be something along the lines of, well, you know, it's a mood. If, you know, good things happen, then I'm happy. If bad things happen, then I'm not happy. If you think about it, it was not too more than 200 years ago that Thomas Jefferson wrote these words: "We have these inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And he wasn't talking about the pursuit of having a nifty time. This was really his way of talking about freedom of religion. And it went, you know, the same ideas later were codified in the First Amendment. But this idea that, and this was something really treasured among the founding fathers, you know, who were coming from a nation where the church was associated with the state. They had this idea that, wow, if you set up this country where there was no, the state was not directing, like, this is how you should live your life and the values you should have, then everyone would be free to choose their highest good and to walk in the direction that would bring them the most personal fulfillment. And, you know, everyone would be able to develop themselves deeply, and they'd be living from this incredibly fulfilled place. And you'd have this nation of these incredibly fulfilled people. And that was sort of the vision that they had. It's kind of sad how far America falls short of that, you know. Similarly, you may be less familiar with a similar piece around the same time, Schiller's Ode to Joy. This is the piece of poetry that was set to music in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And there he talks about, you know, joy is something where, you know, brings all, you know, all men would be like brothers and be living together in this tremendous worldwide harmony. And again, this idea that if everyone were allowed to fulfill their own destiny, and just to, I could live out my authenticity to its fullest, and each one of us were doing that, that there'd be this incredible harmony. And really that is the ideal that was held for happiness at that time. This idea of this sort of overall life fulfillment that comes from living from the deepest part of who I am. And in many ways, that's not too distant from some of the ideas that we find in Buddhism. And it's sad to me that I think if you asked a lot of people about what is happiness or what makes you happy, we'd get all kinds of ideas, we'd get all kinds of answers that I think are what I would call poor substitutes for happiness. Some of the worst substitutes for happiness are the ones that are driven by shame behaviors, and these are things like always being right, or, you know, topping behavior. You know, look at me, you know, ha ha, I'm better, you know, you got this wrong, I got it right. You know, like that kind of, you know, that, you know, quick put down sort of behavior. Any of this, competitiveness with a real kind of harsh edge, all of this is driven by shame. Shame is the emotion, it's a universal emotion, we all have it. It's the emotion that, it's the feeling that I am the lowest thing in existence. And so if I'm not confronting that, and if I'm not comfortable with that, then what I'll tend to do automatically is look for chances to put other people down, because at least at that moment that I put somebody else down, I'm having the relief of, wow, at least I'm not the lowest person in the universe right now. They're a notch lower than me, you know, that kind of thing. Some people go through their life angling for moments like that. And they may confuse that for moments of happiness. And what's truly sad about that is that if I'm driven by shame, and I put somebody down, well, that might, I might experience that as a momentary, like a momentary rush and a momentary relief from my own shame. But of course, we all have that capacity for empathy in us. That no matter how buried it is, it's always there. And so if I'm putting somebody down, I'm also ashamed of the fact that I'm putting them down. And then so then there's just more shame the next time, you know? And so it's actually a horrible, vicious cycle. You know, being right and proving other people wrong, like that whole category of things. So that's one category. Another category is pleasure. And from the point of view of Buddhism, there's nothing wrong with pleasure. There's absolutely nothing wrong with pleasure. It just doesn't last, you know. As long as there's pleasure in the present moment, enjoy it. Just know it's not going to last, you know. As soon as we get into, you know, this, you know, the pleasure's over and then we're strategizing, well, how do I get more of that? And how do I rearrange things so I get, you know, the strategizing about pleasure, that's not pleasurable at all, you know. Pleasure is not really a what I'd call a secure basis for happiness because of its fleeting nature, you know. It's wonderful that we can enjoy it the moment it arises, but it's not something on which we can, as it were, build our character. One of the trickiest is, and this is a word that I spent a lot of time thinking about and a lot of time kind of researching what people said about it, is the word excitement. And what's the relationship of excitement to happiness? And excitement is an interesting word because, as I found, there's this wild range in what people mean by excited. You know, at one end, excited could be this very calm, grounded, contained, you know, yeah, I'm looking forward to something, you know, that kind of thing. Anything that's relatively grounded and calm, I mean, you know, of course, there's always a danger of putting weight in expectations, but there's nothing particularly harmful about that. What I would have the most concern for is the other end of excitement, which I've heard some authors call overexcitement, the heart-pounding excitement, the excitement of thrills, you know, the adrenaline rush kind of excitement. And I think there are a number of people in this culture who mistake that for happiness. And that's a big problem in many ways. First of all, it's an addiction. Adrenaline is an addiction. And as with many addictions, we build tolerance to it. And so if I go after thrills, after time, the same things are not going to thrill me as much. And then I'm going to have to go on bigger thrills. And I'm going to have, you know, it's going to have to be, you know, whatever, more and more reckless or whatever. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, that revved up wild kind of excitement runs on the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the same part of the nervous system that stress runs on. And so when we're practicing being wide-eyed, adrenaline-rushed, excited, we're also practicing stress. And so a life high in one is going to be high in the other, you know? And I don't think people realize that at all. And of course, it's just the nature of everyday life that, you know, it, you know, maybe in conditions of war, you can have nonstop thrills or, you know, on a jungle safari or something like that. But, you know, in modern, you know, Berkeley existence, day-to-day life is relatively scarce on like heart pounding thrills, you know, and you really have to engineer, you know, you have to, you know, do your skydiving or your jet skiing or whatever on the weekend. And so what it means is that there are these long periods of sort of downtime. So there's these punctuated moments of the high energy excitement and then these long periods of downtime, likely filled with a lot of stress. And I think some people would call that there, you know, the idea that someone would call that a life of happiness is really concerning to me, you know? Happiness, I would say, is something much calmer. It's something much more low-key and relaxed. It's something very much aligned with the parasympathetic nervous system. It's an ability to relax into myself, be at peace with myself, be at peace with my surroundings, be at peace with who I am, be at peace with what's happening with others. That's happiness. It's very close to equanimity. And in fact, there's this important connection between happiness and equanimity. There's also an astonishingly important connection between focus and happiness. In some ways, this, I think, is one of the great teachings of Buddhism, that, you know, that if we, what we want in life is happiness, we can't neglect our focus, that developing our focus is essential for developing our happiness. And of course, one of the things that brings us deepest fulfillment is connection. We're wired for connection. And so love, not only self-love, but love and care for others, acts of compassion. The Dalai Lama often says one of the best ways to pick up your mood is just to start acting compassionate to people, you know. And so it fascinates me. I don't know how many people, if you ask, you know, in America these days, if you ask them, you know, what are the steps you should take to be happy, or what would you need to be happy? You know, people might say money or more this, or, you know, promotion or blah, 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 or change of political parties or whatever. I don't know how many people would actually say, well, I need to be more compassionate, you know? And yet there's actually evidence that moving in that direction brings genuine happiness, you know? So it's, in some ways it makes me sad how unfamiliar people in the modern world are with their own happiness, you know? So that's why I'm giving a Dharma talk on it. Not that anyone listens to me outside of this room, but there you go. So I'll hand out the quote sheet. So Mr. Buddha said, learn to let go. That is the key to happiness. Aesop, the great teller of fables, says, the unhappy derive comfort from the misfortunes of others. And again, this is this shame-based kind of thing of putting other people down or competing with people. The wise emperor Marcus Aurelius says, very little is needed to make a happy life. It is all within yourself in your way of thinking. I love this one from the poet Hafiz. Ever since happiness heard your name, it has been running through the streets trying to find you. From our very first lady, Martha Washington, the greater part of our happiness or misery depends on our dispositions and not upon our circumstances. The polymath Goethe says, the person born with a talent that she is meant to use will find her greatest happiness in using it. And there is something about bringing forth our gifts and being productive that is also very much connected to happiness. Gandhi says, quite simply, happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. I like that. This sort of deep lining up, you know, you might say, all the chakras in sync. Ellen Montgomery said, it's been my experience that you can nearly always enjoy things if you make up your mind firmly that you will. Hesse says, happiness is a how, not a what, a talent, not an object. Helen Keller, that wise woman, says, many persons have the wrong idea of what constitutes true happiness. It is not attained through self-gratification, but through fidelity to a worthy purpose. James Oppenheim says, the foolish man seeks happiness in the distance. The wise grows it under his feet. Journalist Rose Lane said, happiness is something that comes into our lives through doors we don't even remember leaving open. And this idea of just living an open life, being open in wonder to the world, sometimes we receive blessings we didn't even expect, you know? William Feather said, plenty of people miss their share of happiness, not because they never found it, but because they didn't stop to enjoy it. Philosopher Ashley Montague says, the moments of happiness we enjoy take us by surprise. It is not that we seize them, but they seize us. And there is a kind of quality of grace to happiness. Anna East Nin says, it is not easy to find happiness in ourselves, and it is not possible to find it elsewhere. Thomas Merton says, by being attentive, by learning to listen, or recovering the natural capacity to listen, which cannot be learned any more than breathing, we can find ourselves engulfed in such happiness that it cannot be explained. The happiness of being at one with everything in that hidden ground of love for which there can be no explanations. Thich Nhat Hanh says, sometimes your joy is the source of your smile, but sometimes your smile can be the source of your joy. Dennis Waitley says, happiness cannot be traveled to, owned, earned, worn, or consumed. Happiness is the spiritual experience of living every minute with love, grace, and gratitude. Gratitude, it turns out, has a huge role in happiness. The Dalai Lama says, happiness is not something ready-made. It comes from your actions. And he also says, I believe compassion is one of the few things we can practice that will bring immediate and long-term happiness to our lives. It's hard to think of something else that fits that qualification. Jack Kornfield says, after more than 40 years of teaching mindfulness and compassion to thousands on the path, the most important message I can offer is this: you don't have to wait to be free. You don't need to postpone being happy. That's actually the opening sentences of that book. I highly recommend that book, No Time Like the Present. Eckhart Tolle says, on a deeper level, you're already complete when you realize that there's a playful, joyous energy behind what you do. This long quote from this blog writer, Sen, I wasn't able to find any other details about Sen. I saw just a picture of him and his three-letter name. Overexcitement can simply be termed a state of high momentum of the mind. This momentum can take any form, light-natured or dark-natured. When it takes the light-natured form, you feel over-exuberant or ecstatic, and when it takes the dark-natured form, you feel over-anxious or depressed. They are both actually forms of excitement or instability, only different polarities. The mind is bound to swing into both polarities. You can't avoid that. And the momentum of your mind will play out in each polarity. The higher the momentum, the higher the swing. You can see how an overexcited and anxiety state can cause you to take frantic actions in the hope of getting back to the exuberant state. You soon become a person craving the high state, or the state of relief, to the extent of taking reckless actions to fuel this craving and looking for different forms of pseudo-security from the outside. And then finally, this quote, fear is excitement without the breath. Every website where I looked at that quote, it attributed it to a different author, so I have no idea who originally said that, but it's an interesting quote.